So today is about coalescent stuff again, just like I talked about last week. So it's a coalescent approach to rare mutant alleles. So I put parentheses here because some of it also applies to non-rare alleles. Okay, so what is the situation we are considering? We're considering something like this. We have a sample of size n, for example, of n genes, and there are two types. So there's one type here, and we find that in decouples, and the other one in n minus decouples. And these guys are mutants, so this is the ancestral type, and this is the mutant type. And we're interested in describing this genealogy here, and maybe we're interested in the age of the mutation that happens up here, and maybe in particular we're interested in this part of the genealogy. Okay, and why are we that? Well, there are different reasons why we're interested in this. One might be a historical reason. So back in the 60s and the 70s, there were a lot of diffusion theory around. It's sort of coming back now again, but there were a lot of diffusion approaches in population genetics back in the 60s and the 70s, and in particular, people were interested in sort of forwards properties. So we could imagine here that we're here today, and we sort of see an allele in frequency X, maybe this is one, and then we would ask question about when would this allele go to extinction, given that it was going to extinction, or when would it go to, how long would it take before it was fixated, and so on. Kimura noticed in 1973 maybe, that he could sort of turn this argument around. So when he was looking at an allele saying, how long did it take before it was going to extinction, given that it was going to extinction, he could turn that around and say, okay, this was the same as asking the question, when did the allele arise in the population? So, okay, so he sort of equated this time here with this time here from when it originated and came to frequency X. So that was sort of a reversibility argument he was applying, saying that what goes on in this direction would be similar to what was going on in the other direction. So using that argument, he found that the mean age of an allele in frequency X was given by this quantity here. So now X is something between 0 and 1. There are sort of various problems with this type of argument, but because there's not a strict reversibility involved here. I mean, when we go in this direction here, we start with two alleles, one in frequency X, and then there's no mutations going on. When we go in the opposite direction here, there's a mutation that sort of originates everything. So there's not a strict reversibility, but Waterson in maybe in the 90s, maybe in 95 or 96, showed that one sort of could make these reversibility arguments correct, so that this was the age of an unusual allele when it's found in frequency X today. In Maruyama, in I think in 1974, he extended this kind of argument to involve selection or to involve genetic selection. And what does this mean? It means that either we have a haploid population with two alleles and one of them is under selection, or we have a diploid population and selection is, we have a sort of a neutral allele, and then the selection coefficient on the heterozygous is S, and then it's 2S on the homozygous. So it's just additivity. He extended this to this situation here, and gave a formula for the mean age of an allele found at frequency X. What was particularly interesting here was that the mean age of the allele did not depend on the sign of the selection, but only on the absolute value of the selection. So if the allele was under positive selection, it would have the same mean age as if it was under negative selection. And I don't think there's any intuition really that could help us find out why this is so. It's sort of counterintuitive. You would expect that something that was under, here we have X, that something that was under negative selection would be more recent than something that was under positive selection, because what was under positive selection could sort of have been in the population for a longer time than the one that was under negative selection. Okay, but Maruyama showed this, I think in 74. Then, you cannot see if I write here, can you? No. Then in the 80s and forward, all these different coalescent approaches appeared with Kingman's coalescent and Hodgson and all these guys getting involved in this, Griffiths. And then there became a big interest in sort of trying to rederive some of these results here, but in the coalescent framework. So you wanted to see how far you could take this approach actually and get some of the same results people have derived using diffusion approaches. So that is sort of the historical background for being interested in this. You would say, okay, now I know these results derived under the diffusion. Could I actually get some of these results from looking at a coalescent approach to a sample here, and then ask questions, how old is the mutation here? And maybe I was interested in looking at bigger and bigger samples such that the frequency of the mutant one was going to X just like here. Okay, so there was this sort of historical interest in getting this. But there was also some more biological interests in looking biological reasons for looking at this scenario here. So one is when we search for SNPs involved in disease. I mean, then we are looking at a situation like this, maybe here, that we have a bunch of cases and similar number of controls. And we observe some mutations in the cases here, and similar some mutations in the controls. And we are interested in knowing whether the cases maybe share a mutation, or part of the cases share a mutation you don't see in the controls. So the sort of the null model here would be that the entire sample here, both cases and controls, would just follow a standard coalescent model, whereas the alternative or our hypothesis would be that the cases have something in common, maybe this mutation here, this situation here, that cases and controls, that the cases would share something in common, so that for this particular mutation here, which would be this one here, they would share a more recent history. And given that they were sharing this recent history here, means that they might also be more similar on neighboring markers. Okay, so you were interested in saying, if I could say something about this, I might be able to say something about the extent of linkage around a mutation, linkage around a mutation shared by the cases, or maybe just a fraction of the cases. Okay, what we know is that under the null model, if the cases don't share a mutation then linkage extends like it scales like the population size here. I mean, recombination rate is normally measured in something like this, where R is a recombination rate per nucleotide site. So we would expect that linkage around an arbitrary site would extend something like scales in the population size of the effective population size of the population. And then we could be interested in asking whether, if these guys here share mutation, how much would they then how long would linkage in that case extend? Would that similar scale in N, or would that be a longer? I mean, if this was a very recent history, we would expect that linkage would extend much further. And if this was a very old mutation, then we would expect that linkage would not extend that much. Okay, so there was this sort of interest in trying to, in relation to this, to try and study this situation here. And the last one, maybe I could put it here, relates to selection. So there, for example, one very good example here, I think, there's this mutation called the delta F508 in the cystic fibrosis gene. It's called CFTR, I think. And this gene code for a protein that makes an ion channel, where I think chloride ions are going through. If you have a double homozygous for this mutation here, cystic fibrosis can be caused by this mutation, but also by many, many other mutations in this gene here. So if you have a double homozygous for this mutation here, so a double homozygous, then you're not going to survive long. I mean, there's some treatment today, but you are still, I mean, a few generations ago, you would die from this disease here. If you are heterozygous for this one, then you can survive. I mean, and you do survive. So you only need one functional copy of the gene. And of course, if you're homozygous for the wild type, then you are fine. Okay, this particular mutation here is found in about 2% of the Caucasian population. Caucasian, that doesn't spell right. In the Caucasian population, and it accounts for, I think, about 2/3 of all known cases of cystic fibrosis. Okay, so it's found in 2% of the population, and people have been speculating how it could be that it was in such high frequency when the double homozygous had such a severe effect on the individual. So people have been speculating that it might be under some form of selection. I mean, so that this one was under severe negative selection, but the heterozygous might be under some form of positive selection. That sort of would drive it up in a certain frequency, a high frequency. And it's been speculated that it could be that it gave you some resistance to cholera and other diseases. And one reason, I don't know the details, but one reason is that apparently when this ion channel is not functioning, then you don't dehydrate as easily as if it is functional. So that might give you an advantage if you suffer from cholera. So people have been interested in finding out whether this particular allele here was under positive selection. And in order to do that, it could be helpful to know something about the genealogy. This could then be this mutation up here, to know something about this genealogy here. And then we might look at intra-allelic variation or something in order to try to figure out that how likely this would be. So there are these different, there's a historical and then there's maybe these two different biological reasons for being interested in this scenario here.
The same argument can be made for...
Sorry?
Well, the same argument can be made for many of the Mendelian diseases.
Yeah. This is just one example that's been studied, but that would be valid for many others. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. This is actually not a SNP. This is a trinucleotide deletion. Where do I have... So what is so the aim is sort of to give you some results for the coalescent, the standard, the neutral coalescent here, and then show you how we can actually get some results also in the case where the allele or the mutant is under selection, positive or negative selection. So first I will give you some results here that only relies on the neutral coalescent, and then I would show you an approach that actually are able to handle selection on rare alleles. And then there would be a few consequences here. Of this, okay. So that's sort of the headlines. Okay, and then I should probably start by again giving a very brief recap about the standard coalescent thing, or the neutral coalescent. So, well, of course, you've been through this, or we've been through this many times before. So, the neutral coalescence is characterized by a series of waiting times. So, we look at a sample of size n, and Wn is the waiting time until the sample of size n has only n minus 1 ancestors. And Wn minus 1 is the time from the n minus 1 ancestors to the n minus 2 and so on. And W2 is the time from their 2 ancestors to their 1 ancestor. In the case that we have a constant population size, then all these have nice distributions. Exponential with I choose 2, and they are all independent. But as soon as we don't have constant population size, they are no longer independent, and they're in general not a nice expression for the distribution. Okay, so that's the waiting time between coalescent events. Then there's a jump process, and the jump process is simply the process that tells you which genes are coalescing when. And that's very simple, because when there's a coalescent event like here, you just choose one of the n, choose two pairs randomly and make them coalesce. And that is because it's a random... it's because it's a neutral process, so all lineages here are equally likely to coalesce. Then finally, we add mutations according to a Poisson process, where this ln is the length of the entire tree here, or genealogy. So, and theta is a scaled mutation rate, where U is the mutation rate per sequence or per nucleotide per generation. And again, so it's scaled in. Okay, we are particularly interested in the situation where the mutation rate is small. And why is that? Well, that's because we're interested in this situation where we just have a single mutation. So we are just looking at situation, say, okay, I'm just looking at this particular site here in the genome, and I'm conditioning on the fact that there is a mutation. So if I just look at this particular site here, one specific site, I know that, I mean, if this is a SNP, then I know that the mutation rate is of the order, maybe of this 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 8 or something, or maybe even smaller. And that effectively is the same as saying that it is zero. So all this is sort of derived in a limit where theta is very small. Okay, when theta is small, then I can get from the Poisson process here that the probability that the mutation happens while there are K lineages is sort of proportional to this guy here. K times the expected value of my waiting time, and in the constant K size that amounts to this. Okay. We need a few more results about the neutral coalescence. So we could call that earned results because they all derive from some earned model considerations. So here we might be looking at a situation where we have K groups. So that could be whether M1 of the first type, M2 of the second, and so on. So we could think of that as different lineages, like here, and they could be of different types, if you like. I mean, different alleles, so like over here. I mean, this one and this one, and so on. But we're just in the neutral case, and then we ask, what is the probability that? So there are m in total here, and then we ask, what is the probability that when there are n lineages down here, that n one of them originates from or descends from the M1 up here, the M2 descends from the M2, and the NK descends from the NK. So this is simply an earned model where you just add, or you draw a ball from up here, and if you draw one from here, then you add an extra one of this color, and so on. You continue until you have n in total. And you get that the probability that to see this is simply given by this formula here. To see, this does not really relate to the coalesced, but it's a very general thing that only relates to sort of an earned model structure. But it's a very useful result, and I'll show you in a little while how this actually plays a big role in getting results for this situation over here. One thing we can use this for is actually also to say what was, if we are down here now, what was the most recent event? Was that an addition of a ball of this color, or of this color, and of this color? So that corresponds to what was the most recent coalescent event. in this situation here. And you can show that it's given by this formula here. So this is things that not at all really, they only rely on this neutrality assumption here, that all lineages are equal. So of course, if this one was under selection, it would no longer apply, because you would be, if it was under positive selection, you would be more likely to add balls to this one than to the neutral ones. Okay, so much for the introductory part here. So let's... get some results here for this situation under the neutral coalescent. So the first thing one could ask was that could we get what is the probability that the mutation happens at level over here, happens at level k, that is while there are k lineages, and then leaves d descendants in the population. And that is just to combine this result here with this result here, saying that if the mutation rate is small, then the probability that the mutation happens while there are k lineages is proportional to this one. So we simply get that it's this guy here, and then times the probability that one lineage, the one experience the mutation, leaves d descendants, and the remaining k minus one lineages leaves n minus d descendants. So that is just to plug into this one in the case where we only have two groups, one with m and one with one, and one with k minus one lineages. And we simply get this. So you can, in the case where we have a constant size, we can substitute this part in here and rearrange, and then actually get a much nicer expression that looks like this. And of course you can derive results in the limiting case, say what happens if you're looking at a very large sample such that the mutant one is in frequency x, and you get things like this here. Okay, let me see here. Okay, this one is just a one step. What is probably more interesting is to say what is then the probability that that a mutation leaves d copies in the population. That would then just be summing over all possibilities here. Say, oh, it could happen at when there are two lineages, or three, four, five, six, seven, or up to n lineages. So that would just be summing over this guy here. And if we just look at the constant size case, then we end up with that this one is proportional to 1 over d. And that is, of course, a well-known result, that this is the frequency spectrum. That if we're just looking at a single mutation, what is the probability that it is found in d copies? It's 1 over d, so we can normalize this here. So this result simply comes out of this EARN model results, and then this simple thing for the Poisson process. You can go on and get a lot of other results similar to this. One particular thing that might be of interest is to say, can I actually, in this situation, say if I want to characterize the generality of this one, it would be nice to know that when I'm in this situation, what was the most recent event here? Would that be a coalescent event among these guys, or would it be a coalescent event among these guys? And to do that, I could simply use this result here and say, okay, if I want to know that, well, I could sum over to most recent event. So I could simply sum over situations, saying that what is the probability that that it happened while there were k, leaving d, and then times the probability that the most recent event was among the mutant ones, and then I have to substitute d for in here. And I don't want to give the details, just say that I mean I could do that calculation. And then in the constant size case, I could just add this one in. And this one simplifies. You can see this one cancels with this one and this one with this one. So you end up with this. So in this situation here, you actually have characterized the genealogy or the coalescence structure in the genealogy. You know that when you are here, then the probability that the next, the previous event going backward was among these guys here is simply d divided by n minus 1. So there's an asymmetry in this process. I mean, because the probability that the most recent coalescent event was among the mutants is a little bigger than the frequency of the mutants. I mean, because you divide by n minus 1 here. And that's, of course, as it should be, because you know that the mutants, they have to coalesce and then experience a mutation before they all can find the most recent common ancestor. So there needs to be an asymmetry in this one here. But this gives a very nice characterization in the neutral case of this genealogy, simply from very few, from urn model things and from simple things about the Poisson process. And as you can see, a lot of this can be generalized, I mean, to more general cases, still under neutrality, but where you substitute this instead of the expression here for the constant size case. Of course, the expressions does not end up being as nice as here, and you might have to do simulations in order to find the expected values here, but still you can get a lot of nice results simply from these, from combining these few results I put up here. So Griffiths and Savary has a lot of results about this in 1998. Okay, so this is just to show you that you can get a long way in this simple case from the neutral coalescent here. But of course, this does not involve any form of selection. You can also ask whether this could be generalized. I mean, these results are so nice and simple, so you could ask whether these could be generalized to include more mutations. You could, for example, say, what if I had nested mutations like here, or what if I had some non-nested mutations that there was another one over here? Could I derive similar results as over here? But unfortunately, everything becomes much more complicated, so there does not appear to be any more than sort of general structure for this. Oh yeah, finally, I should probably mention that in this case of a finite sample here, one can also derive the age, and let's just put it for the constant size case again. One get an expression like this that doesn't look so nice after all. Plus one. But in the case when the sample becomes large and the fraction of the mutant ones goes to X, then we are able to re-derive Kimura's diffusion result here. So there's a nice consistency between the diffusion approaches and then the coalescent approaches here. Okay. So let me see what it is. Okay, so in the neutral case, we could derive all these nice results and learn a lot about the genealogy of a sample where there's just one mutation. So now we want to look at a situation where the mutant here is under selection. And everything breaks down when we look at selection, because these results here do no longer hold for selection, because you would be more likely to... Well, depending on whether you have positive or negative selection, to add the selective ones or the non-selective ones. So we need a different approach to do that. There's a coalescent of that includes selection, but it's a very complicated object, and it does not seem to easily provide insight into this situation here. So we have to do something else. And what I'll show you one approach to do this. There might be other approaches as well, but what we in particular would be interested in is just to look at this situation here. So we are no longer interested in the entire situation here, but we will just focus on the mutant ones. So we will try and derive an approximation for a mathematical description of the genealogy of mutant ones when they are under selection. And how can we do that? I think I can get rid of this. Okay, so now we are going to look at a specific discrete model for population, for a population. Maybe it is the chalk that makes me cough all the time. Okay, so here we would look at a Moran model. And the Moran model is one of many models that actually, when the population size n is large, leads to the standard coalescent model. But we would like to include to this Moran model, we would like to include selection. Okay, so how does the Moran model go? I mean, we have a population of size n, and we can just think of it as a haploid. Some of it can be carried over to a diploid, but let's just think of it as a haploid model. And then we reproduce, and the way we reproduce is that we draw one gene at random among the n guys, and that one gets give birth to a new individual, and we choose one to die at random, so that could be this one, for example. And all the remainings, let's say it's this one here. So all the remaining ones we just keep in the population. And then we continue like this. Next time it might be that this one is giving birth to a new one, and another one is dying, and so on. So if you compare this to a Wright-Fisher model, it's a much slower reproduction process, because in the right Fisher model, everybody would reproduce, and not only one individual would have offspring, but many potentially has offspring. So this is a much slower process. And in fact, if you look at the offspring distribution, then on average, of course, they just have one offspring, but the variance of the offspring is very small, so it's 2 over n. So that means in coalescence terms that if you compare that to a Wright-Fisher model, where the offspring also have on average where each individual on average have one offspring, but where the variance in the number of offspring is almost one. So that implies that you sort of need 2 over n generations in the Moran model in order to reproduce one Wright-Fisher generation. So this is a much, much slower process than the typical Wright-Fisher model. But it has some very nice properties, and one property is that if we look at the time until a given individual here is involved either in a birth or in a death of a birth event or in a death event like here, then we see that the probability that it takes, let's say, k generations is 1 over 1 minus 2n to the power k, and then times 2 over n, and then times a half if it's a birth, and times a half if it's a death. But that's not the important part. The important part here is that this is actually a geometric distribution, and the geometric distribution is very close to an exponential distribution. So reproduction structure in the Moran model is very simple. It's almost like an exponential. You just wait an exponential time, and then either a birth or a death happens. And that is important in our case, because that means if I only focus on one individual here and follow it through, and then it suddenly give birth to an extra one, and then I follow the two of them and so on, then what I effectively have is a birth-death process. With an exponential birth rate and an exponential death rate. And that is true as long as I just have a few individuals, as long as I just follow this one and it give rise to 2, 3 and so on. As long as the number of offspring is small compared to the entire population size, then I can characterize it by a birth-death process. So if I go back to my situation here and say, okay, let's say now I have a population here. I have the Moran model population. And then suddenly there's a mutation happening here. Then this one starts to reproduce, and maybe here give rise to an extra copy and so on. Goes down here. If this number down here in the population, out of the entire population, is small compared to the entire population, then I can describe this part here simply by a birth-death process. And that's, of course, a very well-characterized, well, it is a very well-characterized process. And there are an awful lot of results for this one. And one important paper is Kendall's from 1948, where he calculates with very general birth and death rates, calculates probabilities that a single individual will leave a certain number of individuals offspring time t later and so on. So there's a lot of results we can just get from the literature for this situation, as long as we require that the number of cases here, or the number of mutant alleles, is small compared to the entire population size.
Why is that? Why does it have to be small?
Why it has to be small?
Yeah.
Because when it's big, then I mean, if I'm looking at many individuals and ask for what is the time until either birth or death here, then I cannot characterize it by n, or let's say I have a k here, so then I cannot characterize that by k independent lineages where I wait exponential time, because I know if one of these here is going to die, then one of the other ones are more likely to. I mean, if this one is dying, then the other ones cannot die, and so on. But if I just look at few, then they are approximately independent, these lineages. So I have to require that I just have a few. But what I still can do is to say, okay, D. If D is the number of mutants in the population, and the population is N, then I have to require that this one is approximately zero, but I can still assume that the number is going to infinity. I just have to make sure that this one is sort of going faster to infinity than the other one. Yeah?
Excuse me, may I assume that in this model, the rare mutations has a higher possibility to keep rare in the population rather than fixed go to the death? Is that true?
I'm not sure I follow you here.
A rare mutation in the history can be fixed in the population,
yeah.
Or just extinct.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this model, it has a higher possibility to keep rare.
No. What I actually are going to do is to. Sorry, just a second. So what I want to do is to say, okay. I mean, I want to say at present time, I have D mutants. And D sort of fulfilling these requirements here, that these. And then I want to ask, what is the probability that out here a mutation arises? This mutation leaves D mutants today, and maybe along the way here there are some lineages dying out. I mean, this one could give birth to something here that dies out later, and so on. And as long as I require D to be small, then I can assume or describe this with the birth-death process.
Oh, I see. So in the standard Fisher-Wright model.
Moran model. Yeah.
But the population size is fixed.
The population size is fixed, but I take the limit as it goes to infinity. Yeah.
From the genealogy, I can see that all the cases are caused by this mutation.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll assume that mutations happen from the wild type to the mutant. With a certain mutation rate theta, and then I would assume that this theta here is also small, because then it's unlikely that I have more than one mutation in.
Yeah. But I think in the association study, why people all talk about rare mutant to cause the disease is because there are independent mutations at lots of loci, and all this can contribute to the disease.
Yeah.
So that's why I recall the rare alleles can contribute to the disease. The other problem, the other motivation is that because the population is growing, the human population is growing very fast. So that's why we have more rare allele than expected by neutral model. So I think that's why people talk about rare allele in association study.
Yeah. I think you might be right. Yeah. So now you mentioned a growing population. So this one, This one can be extended to include growth, and in fact it could be extended to include many different demographic scenarios. It's, I mean, of course, mathematically one has to fiddle around with it, but it's possible. So I'll show you some results where we assume growth in addition to the selection. Okay, so where were I in this paper here? Should we have a break or? Okay, so I should mention, so what I showed here was just sort of a neutral Moran model, but you can include some forms of demography, and the results I'll show you just include, growth, exponential growth, and then of course we can include selection, that's the whole point of it. And so what is the difference here between selection and exponential growth? Because they are sort of often equated. I mean, the idea is, of course, as if this is the timeline here. If growth would affect all individuals in the population equally, so. So it affects this guy equal to this guy and this guy and so on here. Well, selection, of course, only gives this guy and all the selected ones here an advantage or a disadvantage, but not this guy here. So there's a difference. I mean, let's say that that under expansion, instead of on average just having one offspring, there might be one plus little r or something like that. So that means that all these guys have offsprings of the order of 1 plus r, and also these guys down here after experiencing the mutation. But if they are under selection, then these guys here will addition have something, a little thing here that depends on the selective coefficient, whether it's positive or negative. Okay, so let me just present the a few results here. So let me do. Okay, so so let's call this here. This is the time of the mutation when it arose. It's T1, and let's say then we can similarly say T2. Is if I look at the D individuals here, then T2 is the time where might be here, where the most recent common ancestor of the D guys is. So that is first here, and then I get the mutation, and then so on. And TJ is the time where the D mutants here have J ancestors. Okay. Then it turns out that there's a very nice formula for the distribution of these times here. A surprisingly nice formula, and it's given by this 1 over alpha here times the logarithm of 1 plus So I explain it in a second. I just write it down first. That is probably the easiest thing to do. Okay, and one more thing. (Clears throat) Okay. So these times here, in particular, I mean the time to the mutation, the age of the mutation, which is T1, or the most recent common ancestor of the entire population of mutants, T2, is given by this formula here, where alpha is the sum of the selection coefficient and the growth rate. And where we in the standard, it has disappeared, I think, in the standard correlation where things are scaled in N, then these guys here are scaled in the size of the mutant population. So that is S times D, and we could, where S is the selection coefficient per generation, per individual. So we could write this maybe as this, where N is the population size, the entire population size, and Q is then the fraction of mutant alleles. Okay, and similar, so this is sigma, and similar, the growth rate is given by this thing here. Okay, so the first insight is that when I just look at this genealogy of the mutant ones, then it scales in the size of the mutant population and not in the entire population. So these times here scale in also in D, or in the size of the mutants. Okay.
X.
And the times are given here as a logarithm to this thing here, where the x's are variables, where x1 is given in this form here.
Right, but there's an x in the.
Yeah, so this is the density. This is the density of x1.
Oh.
It's this kind. Sorry about that. Okay, and then the subsequent ones are just exponential ones here. These x1s, x1, x2, x3, and so on, can actually, at least in some cases, be related to the number of ancestors. If I were looking at the entire population and then saying up here, the xj's are sort of related to the number of ancestors in the entire population at that time. But that does not matter for here. I mean, the thing is that we just get this very nice expression. The dependence on the growth rate is here, and on the sum of the two is here. In particular, we see that if I say there are no growth, that is beta is zero, then this part disappears and this one is also zero. So I see that the times here only depend on the absolute value of alpha, and in this case here, which is just the absolute value of the selection thing, and that is in agreement with this guy here, Maruyama, who showed that under selection there was no, the age was did not depend on whether you had negative or positive selection. Okay.
So what is xj at the bottom there?
What's
written there?
Here?
Yeah.
Xj is an exponential variable. So that goes in here.
So the probability distribution of xj is exponential of
one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So to get the tj's here, I simply just have to generate a lot of exponential variables, and then this guy here, and then plug it into this one and do this. Okay, so that is one thing. The other thing is that when... the first thing was this, that it only scales in the size of the mutant population. This might be the second thing. And the third thing is that when there's positive growth here, then that affects the times here differently from what selection is doing, because I have the growth coefficient here and here. And that's of course not surprising. I mean, we already noticed that growth was affecting everybody equally, while selection was only affecting the mutant guys.
What's the dependency on the F of xj? How does it work for us?
Sorry?
F of xj.
F of x, for example.
Yeah, that depends. So what's the impetus?
So there's a J here, and then
right.
I sum J guys here.
So for example, you wrote F of X1 and F of XJ.
Yeah, okay, so this is X1. Yeah. Oh, sorry about this. This is X1, and this is...
the last one.
This is when J is bigger than 1.
Oh.
So sorry about that. So it's only the first one here, where you have the dependence on the coefficients here, and the remaining ones are just exponential ones. Yeah. I mean, it also makes it fairly easy to simulate, of course, because these are easy to generate. But one thing that is sort of interesting is, I mean, so T1 is the age. So we get an explicit expression for the age. I mean, that would just be, I mean, T1 is then simply given by this log 1 plus 2 x1. Okay. Whereas if we go back to the neutral coalescent here, then there's not an explicit, or not a very nice, at least, expression for the distribution of the age of the mutation here. It's a much more complicated product or distribution than this one here.
Why just the first depends on the and not all the others?
The idea is, let me see if I can explain that a little better than I tried to do before. The idea is that so this is just the mutant guys. If I now said, okay, this is the entire population, so up here I have n minus d non-mutant guys. So if I trace the, and I have a number of individuals here, so if I trace the entire genealogy of the population here, then these guys start to coalesce and so on. And then I find a common ancestor for the mutants, I find the mutation, and then these guys can start coalescing here. Okay? So X1, this guy here, I can relate to the number of ancestors it's not a very straightforward way of doing it, but I can relate this X1 to the number of ancestors at this time here in the genealogy of everybody. Okay, and that depends on the different coefficients. And then X2 is sort of how many ancestors do I get when I go from here till this is the most recent common ancestor of the mutant guys. So how many ancestors do I get extra? So that's X2 is the number of ancestors I get from going from here to here. And that's sort of independent of the... Well, I don't think there's a deep intuition or something here, but this is independent of the coefficients. So only how many there are here depend on whether you have selection or growth and so on, and then how many ancestors you add in each step here becomes sort of independent of growth and selection. No, it just means that in this description here, as soon as we have provided a description for the time here, then the rest is sort of follows more straightforwardly without being dependent on. I mean, if I try to describe it from the bottom here, then all the times would depend on the coefficients. So what do I have to add here? I mean, you can rewrite. I mean, in some cases, let me put that here. In some cases, for example, if there's no selection and no expansion, then, for example, all the TJs, you can find very nice distributions for them like this. This is a J. And you can find something similar if you just have selection but no expansion. Then you can get some explicit expressions instead of these more complicated compound expressions. Then you can get things like this. This is a factorial here, and it says J plus 1 here. Okay, then there's just one thing left. What is it? Okay, so there are two things left then. I mean, so the thing is that this one scales in the number of mutant alleles, and it was derived under the assumption that the number of mutants sort of were few or rare in the population. When you do simulations in order to check how good this is, and it actually turns out that for these times here, for example, this is a very good approximation, even when the frequency of the mutant is up to 10%, and in some cases even higher. So mathematically, strictly speaking, it's only valid in the limit as Q is disappearing, but in reality it turns out to be a very good approximation even for reasonable high frequencies here. So that's a nice thing, of course. And the other thing I wanted to say was, let's go back to our original genealogy here of some mutant ones and some non-mutant ones. Now we know that if these guys here are in sort of low frequency, then this genealogy here scales in the frequency of the mutant allele scales. And well, sort of these guys here that are described by more a standard coalescent approach, this genealogy would scales in N. Okay. So in the disease setting, this implies, or not just in the disease setting, but if we are looking for disease mutations, this would imply that linkage sort of decreases with a factor that depends on N, whereas, or linkage extends something that depends on N, whereas in the small genealogy here, it goes like Q. So it means that we should expect around a rare disease mutation to see a much bigger area, a genomic area shared by the disease guys than by these guys here. And that's of course not I mean, it's not surprising that they should share more because they have a mutation here that's fairly recent, but that it's Gates and Q is sort of nice. You might be able to use that in association mapping tools, so that what you're actually looking for here is something that extends over a much larger region than what you're looking for here. Okay, I think that's about getting to the end.
So do you understand any better why it depends just on the absolute value of selection?
No. I mean, I really want to know, but I... No. But I mean, it's only in the case, I mean, you can see it's only in the case when there's no growth, because otherwise it's the sum of the two.
So we have an approach to calculate the selection coefficient, depends on the mutation, and have a constant growth coefficient. Can we use this kind of theory to do the backwards simulation?
Yeah, you can simulate trees with this approach here, because you get all the time from here.
But in this, because the mutation and the collisions is not independent.
Sorry, say that again.
I mean the collisions event is not independent to mutation event.
No, I mean no. Again, if you had a sample here, and you had some intra-allelic variation, then of course you had similar problems to calculate the probability of these things as you have for the standard coalescence, where it's. But now many of you were not here 2-3 months ago when Griffiths talked, but I can see that he talked about calculating these probabilities of a data set. And calculating the probability here of a data set, where they all share a mutation, and then plus some intra-allelic variation, that is as hard as it is in the standard coalescence to do that. But sort of these things here have been used, and I've done that myself actually, in that case of cystic fibrosis, to try and argue in favor of a positive selection on the heterozygous. But the data I used, and sort of it was a little too ad hoc. I mean, I think one should redo that analysis and use some of the. I mean, one could again use all the SNP data that are available to sort of get the demography and estimate that from independent data, and then look at intra-allelic data around in the cystic fibrosis gene to sort of estimate whether it's under selection or not.
But again, it would sort of be playing off the two classes of the mutant class against the non-mutant.
No, if you get the let's say we know the demography here, maybe from other data, and then if I have a sample all sharing, let's say this delta F508 mutation, and then with some additional intra-allelic variation from in the gene, then I could actually, I mean, using maximum likelihood or something, I could estimate the selection coefficient based on that. I mean, without having to use non-mutant data. But I guess I could probably do a better job if I included some controls also.
So this is basically a coalescent way of characterizing ongoing sweeps.
No, it's not really. It could not really handle a sweep because this one only gets in low frequency.
Oh, that's right. So, but a little later it will take over.
So yeah, but
you're catching an ongoing sweep
why can't the thing? And what you see is a reduced variation of all the good things that we expect of it.
Yeah, but I would just need another approach, sort of to.
Sure.
But this would be the sort of the takeoff of the beginning of the suite, the very early part
ongoing.
Of the suite.
Ongoing.
Yeah.
So, however, for your cystic fibrosis case, that thing presumably is maintained by balancing selection, or whatever, right? So that thing has been kicking about for a while. So do you expect this to apply? Right, that's not a new mutation, conceivably, right? If you think.
Oh, I think, I mean, there are many estimates of ages, and some of them, I think they go from about 10,000 to 60,000 or so.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you have something like a heterozygote advantage, then you can maintain a mutation at low numbers for a very long time. Right. So can I still think of it in this way?
So I'm not sure I follow you. I mean, this sort of applies also in the situation where, I mean, if we have the mutant. In the diploid case, where you have some selection on this guy, maybe negative on this guy, just like in the cystic fibrosis case, and then you have positive or something selection on this guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we can maintain
where you sort of maintaining this guy
in the population forever.
Yeah.
So there is no net exponential growth of. The allele.
Or at least there's a slow growth. Yeah. No, there's no, because as soon as this one gets in certain high frequency, then they are removed again. Yeah.
But the mutation was not recent. I guess that's the
point.
Well, I guess it's fairly recent.
Well, that's another assumption. But you can imagine. In principle, right?
Yeah, you could imagine in principle maybe something that would.
Not every low frequency mutation, or SNP for that matter, even under the action of selection, is on the way in or out. Right?
Yeah. Well, I guess it's. I mean, I still guess that it's not likely that you would. I mean, like keep going like this in frequency for a long time, because there would at any point here. I mean, there would be some chance that it would die out, and you would sort of go through that many, many, many times. So the probability that you up here would see certain frequency and you have been going on for like this for a very long time, that would be very unlikely. In principle, I guess, yes, but with low probability.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the alternative, like with the cystic fibrosis or hemochromatosis, you know, perhaps it was rapid selection, for a rare mutation. They're always in heterozygote. It's kind of straight heterozygote selection, and the homozygotes hardly come in. But then, subsequent to that selection, probably up to 2%, then maybe there's some other kind of selection operating, but not such a strong advantage. And then your model is asking something, what the average selection would be if it had occurred over the whole period, when in fact it occurred more rapidly or something like that. So would be something of an average approximation to something that happened faster earlier. Or something
like that. Well, you could actually, in this birth death sort of thing, it would, I mean, if you knew how to model how selection has been going on,
then
you could actually put that into, I mean, that birth death thing handles very general situations. But of course, you need to have some idea about, I mean, how to model it.
Well, in some cases, you know, there's hypotheses based on knowing the pathways or biochemistry.
Yeah, yeah.
Something's better.